it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind this week, during the 2016 presidential race, I spoke with the Washington Post media columnist Margaret Sullivan a number of times to discuss the challenges of reporting on Donald Trump's candidacy. Since Trump took office, the questions have only become more difficult. How much attention should journalists pay to his tweets? How should the press report on his administration's false statements? And how to respond to the relentless cries of fake news? Just days out from the midterms, I wanted to check back in with Margaret. What has the media learned in the last 2 years? Margaret Sullivan joined me from NPR's New York Bureau Friday morning. Margaret Sullivan, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Diane. Always good to talk with you.
We've had pipe bombs sent to Democrats. We've had shooting at a Pittsburgh synagogue. You have indicated that Trump's rhetoric is going to have dangerous consequences. Is this exactly what you've been worried about?
Well, it is. And it's strange because I wrote a column last week when the pipe bomb crisis, I guess we can call it, was happening. But before the Pittsburgh synagogue massacre tragedy, and, you know, I talked about how I was fearful that the atmosphere of rancor and the president's rhetoric against the press and against different ethnic groups could create, you know, it's not a direct tie, obviously, but I think it amounts to an atmosphere in the country that perhaps allows people to sort of tip over into violence or encourages them to.
So you see this connection between hateful commentary on the part of the president and terrorizing acts, whether they're mail bombs or whether they're actual shootings.
Well, I'm fearful of that, and it certainly doesn't help. You know, the president, I think, ought to be doing everything in his power to heal the country, to bring the country together, to calm things down. And though he gives a nod to that and will say those kinds of words at times, then he's back to doing his rallies where people are chanting and it's, you know, vile things about the media and his political opponents. And this is a level of hateful rhetoric that I don't believe our country has ever seen before. So, you know, I don't want to go too far in saying that it's a direct connection, but I do think there is a relationship, yes.
So the president then goes to Pittsburgh to offer his condolences to the members of that synagogue and to the residents of Pittsburgh in general. But then he brings George Soros into it. What did you make of that?
George Soros, the philanthropist, liberal philanthropist, the mere mention of his name has become kind of a code in right-wing media, certainly, for anti-Semitism in a way that's very easily understandable but not direct.
But how could or why would he link this caravan coming from Central America to George Soros, saying he's behind it, he's financing it?
Well, it doesn't make any literal sense, but it makes sense if you know how the president, you know, ran his 2016 campaign and really has continued through his presidency, which is to make fearfulness about immigration the core of his appeal. So when the going gets tough politically, the president reverts to what I consider fear-mongering about immigration. And the business, you know, all of the attention to the caravan of these desperate people coming up through Mexico toward, but not very close to, the United States southern border has been exaggerated far beyond what it should be. And so it's all of a piece, but I think it has a political rather than a realistic or literal purpose. You have to sort of understand it for what it is. So therefore, if you know that that's what's going on, then all the trappings of it, including any links to George Soros, all fit in to what is at least arguably a white nationalist perspective. I mean, the president himself has said he likes to be identified as a nationalist. He doesn't quite go so far as to say white nationalist, and I don't think he would. But he's proudly said, yes, I consider myself a nationalist. And people understand what this means. It's also of a piece with not fully renouncing what happened in Charlottesville with the white supremacist movement there. So, you know, it's all very troubling.
Well, certainly troubling as to how the media should report on, reflect on, advise on what the president is saying. What kind of a job do you think the media is doing?
Well, I'd love to be able to say great, but I cannot. I think that there's been way too much gullible attention paid to the caravan, which is, by all reasonable accounts, does not present a threat of invasion to the United States. And yet, TV particularly, but I think not just TV news, has paid attention to it in a way that the president generally wants them to, as a big threat to the country. And I think that that lacks perspective, it lacks skepticism, and it lacks all the kinds of things that we need the media to be doing. You know, President Trump is very good at creating the show every day. And the show for the past couple of weeks, as the midterm elections approach, has been about immigration, has been about the caravan. You know, it's very interesting to look back at the coverage of the 2016 campaign. When people were asked months before the election, what one word do you think of when you hear the name Hillary Clinton? And to a large extent, people said email scandal, et cetera, with Benghazi kind of a second runner-up. When they were asked about Donald Trump, the word was immigration. So, you know, he got elected that way. And I think that it's continued to be his go-to when he really wants to get his base fired up and make the country come to him around this issue that's, you know, kind of fear-inducing.
But I'm back to the question, should the press simply ignore what the president is saying, or is there a better way that they could be reporting on it rather than simply reporting on what he says? And then, for example, as far as birthright citizenship is concerned, saying that he cannot, as president, simply wipe that out, but that that is or would require a constitutional amendment. You know, I think the press is caught between a rock and a hard place. I mean, do they report or don't they?
You're right. It is tricky, and there's no one formula for getting it right. But one of the things that has gone wrong is, of course, we have to cover the president and what he says.
Yes. You know,
that, I think that goes without saying. But we need to do it with context right away and with fact-checking right away. So with his statement that he was going to try to undo birthright citizenship just a few days ago.
Right.
The way it was reported immediately in headlines, in tweets, in news alerts, which is the way a lot of people get their news, they don't necessarily read a 800-word news story, was simply what he had said. And it lacked the element, those shorthand ways of getting information across, lacked the immediate skepticism of, well, but, you know, he probably can't do it. So you'd see you know, an AP or a Bloomberg news alert that sort of said, this is what Trump says. Here's he's going to do this, or he's going to try to do this, without the element immediately of, and it's not very likely that he can, or most legal experts don't think this can be done by executive order, and it would take a constitutional amendment. So we know that now. And if you're a heavy news consumer and you like to read the New York Times and Slate and listen to NPR, you absolutely know that. But the way it was portrayed immediately, and I think to much of the country, lacked that element. And that's where I think we as the press have to do much, much better, not just sort of taking what the president says at face value and reporting it as if it's true, because we know for sure that a great deal of what he says is not true.
So rather than have the headline read, Trump takes away, or Trump wants to take away, birthright citizenship, what would your headline be?
So it would need to include another element, that Trump vows to remove birthright citizenship, even though he probably can't. And I actually saw a BuzzFeed News headline that said it pretty much that way. So not just what the president says, but what's the reality here? And I think without some kind of, you know, maybe those wouldn't be the exact words. And
sure,
those words work well on BuzzFeed News, but I don't think the Associated Press would use that particular construction. But I think the same idea has to be there. Legal scholars say it's impossible, you know, and yeah, it does require a few more letters.
It does, yeah.
It does. But I think we must do that. Everyone knows at this point. There's no question. I think the president's most fervent fans would agree that he doesn't always speak truthfully and isn't really tied to keeping things truthful. They get that. So I don't think it's disrespectful to the office or to the person. It's just responding to what we must do. You know, there's a linguist and a scholar, George Lakoff, who talks about how to cover Trump differently. And I wrote a column about it at one point and used the term truth sandwich. So the truth sandwich, instead of saying, well, here's what the president says, and then sort of much later in the story or the broadcast, but this isn't exactly true, is to first say what the true situation is, then what the president has to say, and then the response or the fact checking. Now, that is really outside the norm of how we are used to getting our news delivered, but we may need to look beyond our usual practices because we have a highly unusual president.
So that leaves it up to the editorial functionaries at the top of each newspaper, then, as to how news does get presented.
Well, as you know, Diane, editing is choosing. You decide what photo to use, what your headline will say, how the story is framed. I mean, these are all editorial choices make a huge amount of difference. And while people, I'll hear from news consumers, I wish you'd just present the facts, you know, that sounds good, and I understand why people would say that, but the facts are presented in various ways always. You're always deciding how to frame the story and how to cover it. Are you going to take the rally and cover the Trump rally in toto, or are you going to wait and do snippets and fact check as you go? There are all kinds of ways to present the news.
Margaret, what about the notion that his supporters believe him when he says, don't pay attention to fake news? How do members of the press combat that kind of argument?
Well, that is a tricky thing, because he has, in fact, convinced a lot of people that we, the what I call the reality-based press, or the mainstream media, is not credible. And of course, it is true that we make mistakes, but we correct our mistakes. And it is true that we bring a certain amount of point of view to things, maybe in the wrong way at times. But in general, we are trying very hard to get it right and to be fair. I think sometimes we go overboard in terms of trying to be even Steven, false equivalency, half this and half that. I think, you know, my boss, Marty Baron, the executive editor of The Washington Post, has the formulation, when people say, oh, you know, you guys are at war with the president. And he says, we're not at war. We're at work. Hmm. And Marty's idea is simply to do the work, do the best reporting we can, and keep our heads down. Don't get into a fight about it. Don't take the bait. And, you know, there are others, and Jay Rosen at NYU, professor who does a lot of thinking about this, says that that doesn't work anymore. That's a sort of old school way of thinking, and we actually have to counter it in a different way. But I think that Marty's approach is the one that makes the most sense at this point.
We noticed that Michael Barbaro of the New York Times podcast, The Daily, tweeted that they would not be amplifying Trump's remarks on migrants. I wonder if you think others should follow suit, simply not pay attention.
Well, we have to make some choices. And I did see Michael Barbaro's tweet, and I think it got very good response. And, you know, he's got a daily podcast. And while it stays close to the news, it's not quite the same as reporting the news on the front page of the New York Times. You know, he's able to make some different kinds of choices there. I don't think we need to be responding to every Trump tweet as if it were a five-alarm fire. We can use some reserve and some good sense about that and bring our own critical judgment to bear as we help news consumers, you know, bring their critical judgment to bear. So I think that that's great. And not to amplify things that we understand that this immigration rhetoric is being done for almost purely political purposes just before an election. And you probably are aware of the very racially oriented ad that Trump has just put out, that it's along the lines of the Willie Horton ad from years ago. You know, so we have to be aware that a lot of what's coming out there in this crazy moment before an important election, it needs to be taken with a grain of salt.
Margaret, describe that ad that's just come out that people have said was very much like the Willie Horton ad that came out during the George H.W. Bush campaign.
It depicts, apparently, I don't know exactly, but an illegal immigrant. You're expected to see this person as an illegal immigrant who is a seems to be a Hispanic person, talking in very vile terms about killing people. And then you see what could be similar to the caravan or a great large group of people, you know, sort of flinging themselves against a barrier as if to say we're invading. And then the voiceover says the Democrats let this person in. The Democrats are creating this. So it's a pretty clear message that by allowing certain elements, and these are not white people, into our country, you're allowing criminals to do their worst.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more with Margaret Sullivan.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's Margaret Sullivan, media columnist for The Washington Post. Now, as we head into these midterms, the question becomes, has the media learned from its experiences in 2016? Are they better able to deal with the reality that is Donald Trump rather than promoting his fictions?
you know, if these are the midterm grades, I don't think that we are acing the course by any means. I think we have learned a few things. Leading up to the 2016 election, there was this idea that Donald Trump couldn't win. And so much that happened was predicated on the idea that Hillary Clinton was going to be the president. And so therefore, we need to cover her in this particularly tough way and try to equate her wrongdoing with whatever Trump had done as developer and reality TV star. We created this false balance that we talked about earlier, Diane. I think we've learned that a little bit. I see much more sort of skepticism about what the results of this election might be. I think we understand probability and polling better, and we're more cautious, we're more skeptical. But in terms of dealing with the president's use of the media to sort of drive the narrative that he wants to have, I don't think we've actually come that far.
Well, and, you know, it continues to be said that President Trump is good for cable news, good for broadcast news, good for news in general. So how do you push back against that?
That's a tough thing. I saw just the other day Jeff Zucker, head honcho at CNN, saying that people say they are tired of Trump and they're sick of it and they don't want any more of it. But when we, meaning CNN, move away from that in our coverage, the ratings go right down. And that's probably, you know, I have no reason to doubt him. It's actually quite an admission. And President Trump himself has said somewhat jocularly, you know, I think the New York Times is going to endorse me in 2020. They'd be lost without me. He sees himself, and he's used this term, as a ratings machine that drives ratings in cable, that drives readership of newspapers and so on. And there's some truth to that. People are fascinated by this figure, whether they like him or not. So that is something that, you know, we're all looking for readership. We're all looking for subscriptions.
Certainly.
We're all looking for ratings. And it's a tough balance. But in the end, the media, the press, is a public service and a public trust, and that has to come first.
So what about the role of social media? Where do they fit into the news landscape right now?
Well, it's a huge factor. There are bots that are amplifying racist messages. You know, we found out, of course, how tainted the 2016 campaign was by what was happening on Facebook and elsewhere. And that really hasn't been solved. So it is increasingly incumbent on citizens to seek out responsible and accurate news media, you know, quality news that they can trust, and, you know, not to just sort of take what their friends are sharing on Facebook or on Twitter at face value, and to understand that they need to do some of the basics of news literacy, like comparing and contrasting and finding places that they believe are trustworthy and following those news outlets. I mean, if you just take what comes to you on your phone or on your laptop, you're going to be in a filter bubble that is driven by a lot of things other than good news values.
But at the same time, if you've got Trump followers looking only at the social media they say they trust, I mean, take the example of George Soros. I mean, they really do believe he's behind this whole immigration parade, if you will.
That's right. And I don't know that there's a whole lot that we in the mainstream press can do about that. I mean, we can present good information. We can try to make it accessible and interesting and available to people. And we can counter. We can do fact-checking, as the Washington Post does a great job of. You know, we can bring all of our tools to it, but we really can't buttonhole people and change their minds. In some cases, it's just not possible.
And that's the scary part. It's as though whatever was believed in 2016 is still believed in 2018. So that says to me that perhaps there needs to be some sort of radical shift on the part of the mainstream media. I mean, take CNN, for example. Every day with breaking news and repeating what it is that Trump is saying, and then behind that, what the truth actually might be. So somebody at the top is going to have to make some radical changes.
That's right. And I think one of the real problems is that any radical change has the potential disadvantage of hurting ratings and cutting into the success that, like him or not, Trump has brought to many media organizations. I mean, it's one of the great paradoxes that he sets himself up as the enemy or that the press is his enemy, and yet he's done a great deal for the finances of the media.
So with all these stories about Trump, what are we missing? What are the other stories that we ought to be concentrating on and really taking seriously as we go into these midterm elections?
I'm concerned about that because, you know, coverage of President Trump and all that he stirs up every day sort of sucks up all the oxygen in the room from the perspective of the news media. And we have really huge, big, important stories or, you know, subjects that go without coverage. And climate change is one of them. I mean, the planet is, you know, according to the best experts out there, at real risk, but we hardly see any coverage on a regular basis. I mean, I wrote a column this week about voter suppression, which is a real problem leading up to the midterms. There's been virtually no network TV news coverage of the voter suppression problems in North Dakota, in Georgia, in Kansas, that are going to be important for races that matter. So we as journalists do need to take a step back and not treat Donald Trump as our great assignment editor in the sky.
And what are your readers telling you?
Well, all kinds of different things, Diane. I mean, I tend to get very, very divided kinds of response. Some very appreciative and thankful. I often will have someone say, thank you for the dose of sanity that you're bringing. And then I get very, very nasty, vile, misogynistic response because I've been critical at times of the president and the way he's treated by the news media. So, you know, the anger and the viciousness that we know is out there has come my way, too. And it's very, very scary and unpleasant.
Has that ramped up over time?
It depends. I mean, I've had it's sort of spiked. And I will say that in the past week or so, because of all the terrible things that have been happening, hate crimes, and I have written about them, you know, yes, I've seen some pretty nasty stuff. But also, it's very heartening because I'll have people write to me or get in touch and say, you know, thank you for pointing these things out. So you just have to kind of roll with it and say, well, you know, I'm just going to do my job.
Margaret Sullivan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Diane. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
And a pleasure is mine as well. Thanks a lot. And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Douglas Bell and Natalie Yurib-Lebker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.